This is GeekSpeak, episode 44 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Good. Also joining us is Dee Dee Hubbard. She's a software engineer working in the clouds and roller derby nerd. Hi, Dee Dee.
I'm a Luigi.
And also Alex Slias, our senior information security analyst from Southern California. Hi, Alex.
Hey there, Lyle. How you doing?
Quite well. Hey, last week, Miles and I, at the end of the show, after the theme, the post-show, started talking about all the coding we've been doing. And when I was editing the show and putting it up, I decided to take that whole half an hour and not put it in the feed. But I've since had a friend remark, hey, I wanted to hear what you guys were going to talk about. So I went ahead and put it up on some place on the internet. And from last week's show, if you look at the very end, there's a URL to that MP3 file if you want to hear us yak on about software. Is that fair, Miles?
If you want to, you know, listen to some nitty-gritty day-to-day coding things, we're excited about it, but it is not necessarily general consumption.
Yeah.
Like you have to already be interested in programming or at least see what the process is like.
Yeah, definitely. We might do that again in the future.
I can't fault Lyle for that decision to drop that from the general feed.
Hey, Dee Dee, give us some information on hardware in the gaming world.
So I don't know if you can tell because I'm remote, but I am literally bouncing right now because Nintendo has released more details about their upcoming console. It's named the Nintendo Switch. That's the file name decided. It was codenamed Nintendo NX before. And it looks awesome. It's going to be a hybrid system, meaning that it will look like a traditional console that you have next to your TV with all the high-def graphics that you expect from next-generation consoles. But it will also be portable. Like, you can just pick it up and pick up in the game where you left off and continue on and even split up the controls so that you can do co-op play on the go.
It looks
pretty cool. And some of the tech behind it is actually using NVIDIA's Tegra system on a chip. So... Mm. It should be fairly powerful for this dual-purpose system.
So this concept is like a full game console thing where it sits under your TV. But anytime you want, you can just slide out the guts of it, which is a tablet that you can connect the controllers to, and now you have a portable game system.
Yeah, so in the link that will be in the show notes, there's a video, and you can see that someone sitting traditionally in front of a TV playing a game. One of the proposed launch games is a Zelda game, actually. And for some reason, they decide to get up and they just sort of pick up what turns into the portable console and attach a few things to the side and they take off.
I got to say, I mean, I got all really excited about the video. My son told me about it, told me about Switch. When I got home one day, he's like, Dad, Nintendo's got one this way. And he just was going off on it. I'm like, okay, that's great. You know, he's excited. He's a 15-year-old in tech and all that. And he's really excited about gaming. And so then later I watched the video because of his prompting. And I got all excited and giddy as well. It feels like something I've always wanted in some ways because, you know, the separation of different devices normally means the separation of the game completely. I'm a little skeptical about the controller snapping onto the sides functioning well as a hand controller and also a side controllers because it rips it in half and connects it to the side of the tablet. But you can also connect just a normal traditional controller as well of your choice. So
The controllers look wireless for when you're at home. And I don't know. I usually trust Nintendo with their hardware. It's pretty robust for kids' hands and kids' destructive tendencies. And the GameCube controller, in my opinion, is still one of the best, most comfortable controllers ever.
Yeah. Thank you, Dee Dee.
No problem.
So, Alex, last couple of weeks I've been kind of hitting a soapbox about artificial intelligence and the possible future of it. Today I was actually having a chat with the Donald bot on Facebook,
yep.
Which is a artificial intelligence bot that doesn't do a very good job. With three questions, I was able to determine that the intelligence was not there. But it's still kind of cool. Thousands and thousands of people are using it. And of course, paying attention to artificial intelligence space is an important factor. So I hear you've got some artificial intelligence news for us.
Yeah, I've actually recently came across an article that Wired put in. It's actually an interview that Wired put together with Barack Obama and Joy Ito. Joy Ito is the MIT Media Lab director. I think we know who Barack Obama is. They kind of sat down and talked about artificial intelligence, the future of it, where it's headed, you know, the concerns in terms of how it affects civilization, and just kind of where we're headed over the next 50 years or so with artificial intelligence. It just was an interesting, lengthy article. So, but for those who are challenged at reading lengthy text, for the millennials out there, there are like three or four different videos as you scroll down. There's snippets of the interview with them all discussing this. So it's pretty interesting. I'd say check it out. We'll have the links in the show notes.
Can I ask your just thoughts on is Barack Obama capable of understanding the scope pretty well? Is he intelligent in this discussion?
You know, I was surprised. He seemed to have a reasonable understanding about what artificial intelligence is, what it implies in terms of how it can be used. So, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't know the deeper technology of it, but he seemed to have a good sense for it. I was actually pleasantly surprised to hear him discuss technology and kind of get it.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine, you know, it's not that complicated a topic point in some sense. You don't have to be a software engineer to understand the general concepts of it. So cool. I'll definitely take a look at that article and probably watch the video.
Yeah.
Anything else on our
AI? And well, as far as that, they also go off of not just on AI. Well, it is still AI, but they discuss topics like self-driving cars and, you know, and neural nets and, you know, just kind of interesting general topics, but it's not just artificial intelligence for the sake of artificial intelligence, but how it applies. Also recently, Stephen Hawking had kind of chimed in and gave a talk where he was discussing AI and kind of sum up the gist and just more just add on to this. It sums it up well with what he said is AI will either be the best or the worst thing ever to happen to humanity. We don't know which it is yet. So it was an interesting kind of quote in view of his is that he thinks it's this great thing, but it's either going to be this massive weapon we're going to destroy ourselves with or this amazing thing that's going to open up our future. Just kind of an odd take from him.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the scarier things about that is that if it's an amazing leap forward in technology, and amazing leaps in technology normally correlate with destructive qualities of technology. And they just seem to go hand in hand. You know, it's almost always harder to destroy, I mean, easier to destroy than create with technology. So,
yep. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it has the potential to be very dangerous for us as a society.
Well, it's not the technology. It's what people are deciding to do with it. How are we as a society going to deal with it socially? And if a technology enables a group of people to further their control, like people who are already in power wanting to consolidate that power, things tend to go badly. If, on the other hand, you have a society that's pushing for a more egalitarian future, they're going to use that technology as an amplifier to make that so. So it really does – it's not so much the technology. It's what are we going to do with it, and that's where awareness and public outreach really makes a difference.
Yeah, well, and that's very true. It definitely is always what we do with it. I mean, the same could be viewed for atomic energy. You know, there's the bomb, and then there's, you know, this massive amount of energy we could provide to civilizations. It is very much how we choose to use it.
Yeah, there's the bomb, there's the nuclear power, there's the ability to inject radioactive isotopes so we can get a clearer view in a CAT scan.
Yep.
And new material science that comes out of that type of research as well. Well, thank you very much for that AI update. It's going to be a continual passion of mine. I'm going to focus more and more about artificial intelligence on this program. So I hope you like the topic. You'll see more of it. Miles, let's get some politics in here.
Well, electronic surveillance. It's continuing to be an issue. When we were talking about, you know, great power requires great responsibility. And right now in our state, our nation's capital in Washington, D.C. area, so Northern Virginia, you are seeing electronic surveillance up 500% since 2011. And almost all of the cases, the criminal cases that are going through federal courts in that area that have to do with this surveillance are in sealed records. The court records are sealed.
So we have no idea what's actually happening.
Well, we have an idea, but we don't know specifics and we don't know the total scope.
Yeah. You know, I just realized that this story we didn't actually cover last week, Yahoo's it's showing that Yahoo has been colluding with the government to scan people's incoming
right,
messages.
Which is still ends up being a really odd story to me because, one, it has not made me a lover of Yahoo in general. The fact that their chief security officer had no idea what was going on and immediately quit afterwards. When your chief security officer doesn't know about a major data siphon off of your systems, that means that you have very compromised security. It also made me wonder about Yahoo's demands recently that the U.S. government take some ownership for going public with what their demands actually were, because apparently they have some limited ability with their speech.
Yeah.
I don't think that Yahoo did the right thing, but at the same time, I think that they do have some leg to stand on to say that the government should be a lot more open with regard to its investigations. Otherwise, it seems a bit too much like the American populace is the adversary to his government as opposed to a partnership, or that the government would be beholden to its people.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just surprised this is only up 500%. Just in D.C. Okay.
Yeah, this is just D.C.
Okay. Maybe that makes a little bit more sense, but yeah. In general, it seems like it would be much higher than that to me.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, the amount of surveillance and that the government has been doing has increased dramatically, especially in the last 5 years.
Right.
Yeah, and this comes from a 1986 law to collect data about user telephone, email, and other internet communications. So when you think about what telecommunications, the internet, and email were like in 1986, you know, this would be 9 years prior to where the internet went officially public. That law may be not what we need today. It may not
be.
It'd be hard. Yeah, it'd be hard to foresee what would happen in those next 9 years, let alone the following 30 years.
Thanks, Miles. Hey, Didi, give us some more gaming news, would you?
Oh yeah, sure. So this week, a really massive voice actor strike is hitting the video game industry. They've been in negotiations for the last 18 months or so, and because voice actors tend to also do like voice acting, not just in video games, but other things like movies and television shows and video. They have a union, SAG-AFTRA, they voted a while back to allow the union to sort of negotiate bonuses for them. So in games that do really well, like say they sell over 2 million copies or something, mm-hmm. In the film and TV industry, actors are commonly expected to get bonuses on that. So like if it does well, you share in some of the profits. So they presented a few options, and most of the game companies have rejected that. So now they're moving on to strike actions, including picketing EA's offices in LA today, I think. But the big concern for the video game companies is that voice acting is a small, tiny percentage of what they who they employ. So 1% to like the 99% that includes game developers, executives, and designers, writers, etc. And because they are sort of a smaller percentage of the pie, it would be easy to sort of, you know, just go along with what they're asking for, which is not too far-fetched or unreasonable sounding when you read into it. But once they start opening that up, and maybe applying that to some of their other people, like their game devs or their tech leads or the writers and producers, that would definitely eat into sort of their bottom line profits. Although in like many industries, if the top executives took a smaller bonus, there probably would be room for all of this. But
we're basically, I mean, because it's a new industry, we're trying to, the industry is trying to figure out where the right divvying up makes sense. Of course, in movie industry, a superstar, a star in general, will get percentage. And that's a standard thing when the name draws in people. So that's one of the reasons why you'd get a Mel Gibson to be in your show. That's the only reason, actually.
it's not just for the top flight talent in movie and TV. It's also like there are bonuses sort of down the line.
Right.
And that's sort of what having a union-backed body will do for you. And
right.
Most of the industry for games don't have unions. They work tremendously long hours and have horrible crunch times coming up to deadlines and whatnot. So people are sort of afraid that this might have a ripple effect to the rest of the industry, but it's all sort of growing pains, and it's a good conversation to have. It's just tough.
Yeah, I guess I was trying to bring up the larger the issue around this occurs in many industries, and the oddity of this industry is that the technical skill set is so connected with the game. I mean, the actual rendering of the character, the modeling of a 3D character, or the animations for certain cut sequences, even walk animation cycles, has so much artistic merit in every one of those steps. And traditionally, you know, you start, the film industry starts out with, you know, stage actors that are being put in front of camera, and it builds from there. And so the people that get credit in percentages are based off of that certain type. You know, you don't have a key grip getting a percentage. They're a staff kind of person. If they're good, they get paid, get more work. But in the game industry, the actual creative endeavor is a much more complicated one, a much more rich one. And I can see that line being unclear. Voice work seems to be a slam dunk in some sense, except that, you know, body doubles for motion pictures do not get percentages normally. And their body's being on screen, right? So there are weird lines based off of historical stuff, and we just don't have that history in the game industry. So I find it fascinating. I think it makes a lot of sense to have it unionized. Didi, are you concerned about this making games more expensive? I mean, what, from a consumer perspective, what would occur? Worst case scenario.
It might cause delays in some of the games you might want to purchase, especially the AAA games, and more like at a year or 2 years out. Or if they stopped work in the middle of a game, it might cause delays. I don't know if it will actually affect the price of games.
I would see more of an effect affecting the quality of the game. Like, there are going to be more bugs by the time it comes out because the deadlines get shifted out. But they still want to release.
Well, would voice actors really affect bugs as much? I mean, this is more on hold for the voice acting overlay.
Yeah, but whenever you do any type of large software integration, anything that gets slowed down means that you're going to have to adapt to, for example, the voice may end up being longer, the timeline may end up being longer than the code that you have put in there. So you need to adjust, and adjusting it may cause some other glitch down the road that you didn't see before. Like, that's, I mean, any large software system is going to have unintended consequences for even the most minor change. Even what you think is going to be a trivial one-off, you know, no big deal, suddenly ends up being, you know, just think of all the times, Lyle, you and I are doing web development. Oh, the font's off a little bit right there. Well, that's just a quick CSS change. 2 weeks later, okay, I think it works. Just make sure you don't do this.
I think that kind of problems existing software development occur all the time. I don't know how much the voice would, but I think that the political structure of maybe the voice union actually succeeds in getting better, you know, percentages and get better compensation. You could definitely see software developers going, hey, same thing for us. And I think that could definitely change the industry quite a bit.
And also, I guess I would think of a game and voiceover, I think of lip syncing. Mm-hmm. Because that's something where you do tie the models and the graphics rendering to what's being said, and you may not know the script. Like, you may have the script, but then what the voice actor does may be slightly different, then they have to go back and adjust for that.
I think that normally the lip movement of voiceover work has actually been codified into, you know, understanding the voice.
But like I said, it's the unintended consequences of things that happen because of that.
Hey, Alex.
Yep.
Let's go ahead and talk about the Kremlin. I think this is interesting that you're pulling this, and I'm curious why. Do tell.
So, joggers, taxi drivers, people basically using their phones or other GPS devices to navigate or track their movement have noticed that they have malfunctions when they're near the Kremlin. So, in central Moscow, they're basically kind of a dead zone around the Kremlin. It doesn't seem to be very consistent, according to some reports. It seems, I think some of the local news was thinking that this is something that is got some sort of pattern to it as to when it's blocked or not blocked. There's been no real official word as to what this is. Putin's spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, he added some comment that he had noticed it too. But they generally think it has something to do with the with Russia's Federal Guard service. That they're doing something to protect the Kremlin from flyovers. There's been for like drones and stuff. There were some comments about how drones tend to use GPS, and by blocking it, you can have a you can create some issues with that. But that seemed like a strange excuse, or at least it's a very bad implementation of keeping drones away if that's what they're trying to do.
Do you think that the way that they're blocking it is to separate the satellites that are in that area further away? I would assume that would affect a larger area. Or are they doing a jamming type signal?
I'm suspecting it's more of a jamming. The Russian Federal Guard service doesn't really control all the GPS satellites out there. So I don't know how they would be able to control this, where the signal is actually available. That doesn't make sense to me. So my guess is they have some sort of jamming around that region so that devices are not able to actually connect with the satellites from when they're inside that space.
Yeah, satellite GPS signals are very weak by the time they get to the ground. And so having something that's at the top of a Kremlin spire doesn't have to be very strong to disrupt that signal.
Right.
Though there is a lot of the systems we have are very good at pulling out that noise. I mean, that's the whole design of it, is a low energy and highly effective way of pulling that sync data out of the noise, if you will. Okay. Well, thanks for that. Okay, interesting mystery. I wonder if there's other places in the world that have that kind of effect. It makes sense that there would be. Of course, another way to do that would be to have it perfectly functioning all the time until you want it to be turned off. And I could imagine that kind of system exists as well. It used to be that the U.S. was basically the one that provided GPS and could control it completely. I don't know if that's still the case, if there's secondary systems of satellites that aren't controlled by the U.S.
Well, I know that a few of the GPS satellites are private, so it's no longer really U.S. government anyway.
Right.
Once you start getting into multinationals, things get really muddy really fast.
Yeah.
Didn't we talk earlier on a different show about how Australia has their own GPS and how they're sort of drifting away from?
Yeah, that was about the GPS tether mark points on being synced to global, and the island is actually moving, and so it's getting off shifted, and they have to adjust for it every once in a while. Yeah,
right.
Now, what's interesting? Continent,
same thing.
I mean, it's interesting is that you have the they're blocking this GPS, but I mean, if there is a jamming that's occurring, there's also a radius to that. So if you're just doing, if you're really trying to block surveillance, for example, if they're higher above that, it's not going to affect it either. So it's curious as to why this is being done. I'd love to see if there's more articles that come out to follow up and find out more.
You're right. If they're not shaping the jamming frequency, if it's just a radius, if it's not shaped angles, then you could be up at 10,000 feet and have no effect at all, exactly where the drones would be. But the people jogging around are getting lost.
So. You think drones are going to be at 10,000 feet? Oh, I guess military ones.
Oh, yeah,
be.
Totally.
Maybe they just hate Pokemon Go.
Can't play Pokemon Go in Kremlin. It's like the one Pokemon there. Yeah.
I'd be very surprised though if airspace weren't severely restricted around the Kremlin. Considering in Washington D.C., the airspace there is highly restricted, so things might get shot down if they're up you know, up at that level.
Yeah, but then again, that then raises the question, why are they bothering with this?
Because this would account for the random person with a drone in their backpack that walks into, you know, Red Square and then lets it loose.
Well, one that actually adheres to no-fly zones would be a better way to do that. Otherwise, it's not blocking anything because they're flying it manually. When most drones actually lose their GPS signal, they don't just stop. They tend to default to manual control.
Yeah, but if you or I were hanging around the Kremlin with a drone, wouldn't you want to make it look like you weren't the one who was controlling it and nearby? Wouldn't you want it to be somewhat autonomous so that you'd have some plausible deniability?
I don't know what you're talking about, Miles. I'm playing my Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, obviously. And I would probably be a few miles away. So.
Yeah, and if you're a few miles away, GPS would be really convenient to be able to control your drone.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so this week at work, I've been working on adding in accessibility features into the iOS app, the Netflix iOS app, mostly for automatic testing. If anyone listening to the show needs assistance in, or it has non-standard use kit patterns for, or non, I don't know how to say this, likes accessibility, to use accessibility features like VoiceOver and stuff on the Netflix app, I'd love to hear about it. If you're listening to the show and use the Netflix app without sight, for example, how is it? How are we doing? Let me know. I'd be really curious because there's actually a lot of investment in that. And because of that investment, our testing framework, which is we're using Xcode's or Apple's XC test framework, uses accessibility as the way to run tests, UI tests. And so as you get better test coverage, you actually, by a side effect, get better accessibility features enabled. So that's been kind of neat to see firsthand. That's a little thing I've been doing at work. And I only bring that up because, Miles, you have an accessibility issue.
Sorry. Yes. In general, the internet is becoming less and less accessible. Let's moving aside from the issue of people are not making HTML pages anymore. They're making pages that take a big blob of JavaScript and then dynamically dump a whole bunch of JavaScript or HTML onto the page. Of various interactions, and sometimes, or most of the time, accessibility can go out the window.
Yeah. I mean, you just generally, if you have a voiceover software that loads an HTML document and starts reading it based off of the metadata in the page, if that document's blank and actually it's being rendered on the fly by JavaScript slightly later, the software might get confused and broken.
Right. Newer software can deal with that well, especially if you have put in some ARIA tags. That's a accessibility spec to be able to say that this is a button, this is a drop down. There are things to be able to give some context to what's being put onto a page, and for the purposes of a web application rather than just a web page. In other words, something that is interactive rather than just display. But one thing that is falling by the wayside and falling under people's radar is the trend towards lighter, thinner fonts. Many design geeks out there like the look of a very well-coiffed font. And in general, the defaults of sans serif or, the Times New Romans, the Arial, are frowned upon as just being lazy. You're just using the default font that's in the browser. It looks generic. It doesn't have any real pizzazz to them. But many of these designers are also in their 20s and 30s.
Good eyesight.
Yes. And so they don't have the same issues with contrast that someone in their 50s, 60s, 70s might have.
Or their 40s. My contrast is degrading.
Yeah, I have been noticing that I have to lift my glasses up to look at a screen when I have my phone when it's getting really close, especially when I'm tired. And yeah, I'm only in my early 40s. Like this isn't boding well. And oh my God, all the stories that I heard from my parents' generation are true. I need to, get those bifocals.
Miles, what's the side effect of this? I mean, what actually occurs as this becomes harder for people to use? It seems difficult. I mean, unfortunately, traditionally, the way people that with special needs work is they actually have to sue the organization that's doing something wrong, and then with the American Disability Act, with that law to support them, and then they get money from that individual. It's like a really kind of messed up way
right,
of dealing with this.
Except that unless I'm unaware of a change, and I'd love if someone could correct me on this, the Americans
with Disabilities Act.
Disabilities Act mm-hmm. was published before a lot of web technology came about. This we covered this about 10 years ago with Southwest Airlines. They had some web-only deal, and but their site wasn't accessible to people who were blind.
Well, actually, this just reminding me of a different article I read about how pop-up ads are horrible for the blind. And looking at that, they specifically mentioned that the Americans with Disabilities Act requires certain sites to be accessible, sites for public schools and government agencies. So I believe that falls under Section 408 guidelines, if you've ever heard of those.
Mm-hmm.
There's another section, too, though, that requires equivalent service. So if you're providing a service in some way.
Right, but those right. did not apply, at least with regard to the online world 10 years ago. I don't know that it's actually been updated. Concerning the amount of gridlock in Congress, it wouldn't surprise me if there was a bunch of back and forth on that, saying you don't want to interfere with business versus, wait, this is what the ADA was all about and the like. But with regard to this, this also comes into the issue of ageism within the tech industry. That we've covered a few times before. Once people hit the age of 40, it becomes harder to get that steady programming job or development job. And I mean, there are many people who do, but there is a definite trend in the aggregate. And you would think that if you had a larger workforce that were older within the tech community, that you'd be catching more of these issues, that someone would go like, I can't read that. And a whole lot of people my age can't read that. But when you have a whole bunch of people who are 25 just cranking out the code, it's not an issue. The color contrast is not an issue. You know, the width of a font and how well you can see it when the font is a dark gray as opposed to black.
Yeah,
like Google search results. It's a dark gray.
Yep.
You know, Aditi, you mentioned the article about pop-up. You want to cover that a little bit more?
Oh, yeah, sure. So especially for people that have low vision or are blind, pop-up ads are really nasty for all of us, but they're really nasty for low vision readers. So you're reading an article or something, and sometimes when you scroll, you'll get like a pop-up like, please subscribe or turn off your ad blocker or something like that. If you can imagine that sort of happening and not being able to easily click on those really tiny close buttons, little X's in the corner, or not even realizing that you've entered a pop-up because it just went into a different mode in the screen reader. Sort of hunting through those things is, oh man, that sounds
Some of those ads are so gaudy and garish, and I wonder also how many of them have been tested for red-green color blindness, example. Yeah. And you know, how would you find that X?
You know, I got to say that sometimes I will turn off those via just coding.
I do the same thing. Yeah. But the thing is, it's because we're web developers and we know how CSS works, and we can just go inspect element, find the overlay element, display none.
You know, instead of display none on Chrome and Netscape in the dev tools, if you select node in the HTML document and you click H, it will hide it. It will set visibility none.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's really cool. So you can – the only problem that is –
well,
only,
visibility none doesn't help.
It hides it. Yeah. I mean it visibly hides it. But you're right that if you want to really delete it, if it's like blocking things, then it gets more complicated. Sometimes they're just hiding things.
Oh, and I forgot to add, even worse, if you wind up in a pop-up, say you're on a site that has maybe been hijacked or it's like a sort of malignant ad being injected – you might accidentally click on a link that takes you someplace not good.
Right. Yeah, definitely. All right. So our main topic, thank you all for the news. That was great. Our main topic for the day really has to do with what's happened on the internet in the last few days. Anybody here experienced any trouble?
Or rather, what hasn't been happening on the internet for the last few days.
Definitely.
I had smooth sailing because I was using OpenDNS from the jump.
Yeah, I haven't really experienced too many problems, but that was more... I wasn't really using the internet externally all that much.
So, Alex, you've collected a bunch of stories around this topic. Why don't you start us out and explain what happened?
Sure. So we had on Friday a massive attack against a company called Dyn, D-Y-N. Dyn, for those who don't know, provides DNS services. Many may know them for having Dyn DNS kind of services where you're at home and your IP changes a bunch, but you can have software installed so that your computer tells Dyn DNS, hey, this is my IP. And that way you or other people can always find your home connection based on a name.
You're describing what a longer term for that is dynamic DNS.
Correct.
That's the abbreviation you're using.
Exactly.
But now, Dyn DNS was a trademark name as opposed to the what you're talking about as a technology.
Yeah.
Right.
And dynamic DNS specifically allows you to have one name for your home network as it changes. Okay, I get that.
Right. So that's one of the common things people know them for. But in general, they provide a lot of DNS services to several other large companies like Twitter, like Netflix. So when this massive attack and reports are basically in the tens of millions of devices, their IPs on the internet were attacking their DNS services, which is known as a distributed denial of service attack. It was affecting other services. Twitter was showing up that the Twitter feeds were not available, or other services like that were just failing because of their dependency on Dyn DNS. This seems to be somewhat related to the distributed denial of services attacks that were done against Brian Krebs. It seems to have a similar sort of MO, but it's just generally showing that we have a massive increase in the number of attacks that are occurring, and the scale is going up.
Okay, so scale is going up on attacks in general, not just dynamic, or just not just DNS attacks, not just DNS service attacks, but in general, all attacks are going up. Yeah,
and distributed attacks are going up. In terms of your direct attack from single system or things like that, I don't really have a good metric on it. I'd say it's going up just because there's more people who have access to the tools that can allow for attacks. But in terms of distributed attacks, there's a lot more out there that's being compromised.
I would think about all of the Windows XP machines, but their numbers are dwindling. But if you have a Windows XP machine right now, chances are you've been hacked.
Yeah.
Just because there's no security updates for it anymore. But those numbers are dwindling. So you'd think, oh, well, the numbers in a botnet would be dwindling commensurate with that, especially because the machines that are running XP tend not to be overpowered. Like the newer systems tend to be faster than those older ones. Mm-hmm. So we should be able to handle that. But we have a huge pool of new recruits to those botnets.
They're filling in those that space. So we have our Internet of Things, which Lyle, you and I talked about at length with a discussion on a router configuration for home to help protect against IoT devices. So yeah, a lot of this is IoT. You have
the November 7th show, Home Network, and we talked about the Ubiquiti Edge Router X, all about how you configure that. And of course, one of the main reasons to use that you use that for is to isolate the Internet of Things in your home from the stuff that you care about, because those things are.
I'm sorry, what was the date on that? That was not
September.
A year. Okay, I was supposed to say, you said November.
Oh, September, sorry.
September. I was supposed to say, like, that was not a year ago.
September 7th, 2016, Home Networking Ubiquiti Edge Router X. Okay, sorry, go on.
So, yeah, so we have all these devices out there that are, as Miles pointed out, filling in the gap. While we might be having fewer Windows XP systems, which were heavily vulnerable, I mean, we still have vulnerabilities that occur for Windows, but it's better than it used to be.
Like the scale of what was there before.
Right. Well, the scale with IoT is just making the XP footprint look minuscule because it ranges. Krebs put together an analysis of the attacks that occurred on his website a little while back. That was the one that had resulted in, I think it was 620 gigabits per second, mm-hmm. something like that.
That was the one where we actually covered it because he had to move over to Google's new offering to protect his network, to keep his system going.
Right. And so he had put together an analysis of the different types of devices and the that are out there, and as well as the fact that most of these are using default or extremely simple passwords. So the summary shows a lot of them are DVRs and IP cameras. That seems to be the majority of the devices that are having this problem. So you get IP cameras being basically surveillance cameras, and it could range anywhere from being your little baby monitor, you know, with a cute little a teddy bear wrapped around the camera, to your security cameras that are up on some major building monitoring, you know, traffic or foot traffic in the area. A lot of these devices are connecting to the internet, or rather connecting to a network is really their intent. Well, I won't go too much into intent, but they're meant to connect to a network, but people are plugging them into a network that is connected to the internet. As such, there's lots of wide-scale open cameras that there's even apps now you can get for your iPhone that just pulls up lists and lists of cameras. You can just go and see what's going on around the world and on through these cameras.
And these cameras, we talked about some, you know, potential vulnerability issues in the software itself. But a big thing that Krebs says in this article is that the problem is that they're not enforcing you to change the default password. So a million Xerox machines go out there and all of them have admin user and 1111 as the password. And yep. So if you get a machine that's a Xerox printer and that hasn't been changed, you can control it. Same thing with a lot of these cameras.
Yep, absolutely. And that's not a new problem. Default passwords is something that's been a problem with a lot of the home routers, with your Linksys and Netgear. People would get it and plug it in and think, okay, I'm good. I can access it. I logged in with the password that happened to be in the manual and everything seems to work great. The problem is that they were supposed to be changing that password. And for a lot of systems like your home routers, they've shifted away from using default passwords a lot now, or the password is not or is unique to your specific device. It might be some portion of the serial number or something like that. So at least they're making it so that it's not just one password for every single model or every single device right. of the same model, or in many cases, the same password for every model that they produced.
However, there's a secondary thing here. Let's say right now, you know, you have a Samsung IP camera, and you hear on this show that actually it's really easy to log into that without default. So then you want to go ahead and change your username and password. And now you change it. Isn't it possible that during that time it was open, someone put a modified firmware on it, and now they can still get into it?
It's possible. If you're connected to the network, to a network that is compromised, certainly it's possible. For the IP cameras I have at home, I connected to them first through separate from my actual network, or rather from anything that was connected to anything except for my computer. It was a Wi-Fi I set up just to connect to them. And with that, I was able to connect and reset the password and enable SSL, because that's another problem, is many of these don't have SSL enabled by default or sometimes at all. So the traffic's not encrypted between the computer that's trying to access and log into the camera and the camera itself. So anyway, I locked down mine, but a lot of these don't do that. And even the problem with default passwords is that it shouldn't be a problem anymore. Many companies have shifted away to require you, but a lot of these vendors that are now getting into the network connected market are not doing it right. They're making a lot of the same mistakes. And right. cameras, for example, are old. I mean, they're an old technology being plugged into a network. They're like, oh yeah, that's easy to do. Let's just take a network card, slap it in there, get some basic firmware, and it should be able to connect to the internet. We're good. They don't really think that through.
Let's be honest here. I mean, you're a security researcher. This is your bread and butter. This is what you do.
Well, not researcher, but yeah, analyst.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, yeah. But security is your field. It is your vocation.
Yeah.
It's what you do on a daily basis. And so you were able to do all of this. What hope does the general person have to manage this type of thing, to even know that there was a problem? Especially because this is not just cameras. People should know this also applies to some Xerox printers, Panasonic printers or
printers are awful. Yeah, printers are awful with that. VoIP phones are really awful with that. There's a lot of that.
Printers are really tricky too, because lots of times people print private information. So, I mean, of course, cameras can pick up private information too, but it's at least not normally data that could be used for identity theft. I got to say that I feel a little, I totally echo what Miles is saying, that, you know, I also know how to make a Wi-Fi network that's not connected, you know, share my Wi-Fi from my computer and connect a device and make sure that before it connects to the internet or connects to any other network that has potential vulnerabilities on it, to make sure to change the default password and turn off ports that I don't need and services I don't need. I totally have that intellectual capability, but I'm not going to do that when I get a camera, you know, when I get a light bulb. That plugs in, I'm going to screw it into a wall and see if my Alexa can actually connect to it. And, because that's the fun part.
And once it works, you're done.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, right, absolutely.
A lot of people will have that camera, that security camera, and they're like, okay, I set it up. Oh, wait, I can't connect to it from the internet yet. And they look at the instructions and say, oh, just open this port on your router. Right. And there you go. And most of the time, actually, the camera will connect up to the company's website, and then you connect to the company to get back into your own home network.
Yep.
And we'll do this because it's the easiest way. It's the easiest way to not have a QA call or a support call to there. So I understand their rationale for it, but it's a horrible model with regard to security.
Yeah. And by no means am I actually saying that I think people should have to do what I did with my cameras. I absolutely think this should be on the companies. The company should be making it so that there is no password until you turn it on, and you part of the setup process needs to be set a password. It needs to be done over an encrypted channel by default. They shouldn't be having unencrypted communications even part of the device. It in today's world, it doesn't make sense to even go down that path as a manufacturer of these devices. I don't understand why they are.
Well, security has always been an afterthought. I mean, think of 30 years ago, playing around with, or I guess that's 20 years ago, playing around with Windows 98. Hmm. And the fact that, if some of you may remember, you had that login screen at the beginning. Like, ooh, how do I get past that? Well, you hit cancel. And then you're on the desktop. But you don't have internet access. You can't connect to any network shares. Like, yeah, but how much did people have on their workstation itself?
Right.
Like, right. Security has been an afterthought for so long.
I totally forgot about Windows 98.
And it's something that we've been slowly, you know, getting better at. Microsoft in general was horrible back in the day, and they've been steadily bumping up, and now Windows is reasonably good with regard to security. It's just that there is such an economic advantage to not caring, as long as there was no security issue at that moment that was preventing the sale.
Definitely.
Right.
Hey, Didi, I want to come back to something you said in the very beginning of this discussion, and that is that you didn't actually have problems with website lookups using DNS because you use a different DNS server. Can you explain what you have set up and why it worked?
When I first started hearing problems, my coworkers were complaining about not being able to connect to GitHub, and I was like, well, it works for me. And while I was watching Netflix and reading up on everybody having problems on Twitter, when I double checked my router settings, I guess past me, maybe a few months ago while I was setting up my NAS, had switched over to the OpenDNS as one of my DNS entries. So I was not actually using the DNS provided to me by my now subsidiary of Google Fiber. I might have still been okay without that, because they probably would have defaulted to Google's DNS, which also didn't have problems. They were able to sort of mitigate that a little bit faster than DIN, because they weren't being attacked left and right.
Yeah, or at least the attack didn't last as long as the time to live on the DNS entry.
Yeah. So to give you everyone a kind of an idea of this, I think all the geeks understand this pretty well, but your ISP, when you sign up, the ISP gives your modem information, including your IP address, but it also gives what domain name service you should use to look up domain names. So when you actually say, hey, I want to know where geekspeak.org is, what IP address gets hit to find out where the root, where that service is. And that can normally be changed. And in any case, your router will do that, and then your modem will do that, give that information. Your router will get that information. Basically, up the chain, it'll use that same information. Normally, in your router, you can go ahead and put in domain name services that you want to use. And Google's one, which I think is 8.8.8.8, right?
That's one of them. That's the primary one.
It's nice to know one off the top of your head. You normally can put in a couple so that if one's not accessible. And then the OpenDNS one that you're using, Didi, what's the IP of that?
It's not one I remember easily. It's 208 dot something, something, something.
208.67.222.222.
So it's one of those ones that you probably want to look up, do a Google search on that one.
And then, of course, that's assuming that you're not using IPv6 and being transferred over by companies because they're actually being proactive and not waiting till the last minute.
So if your ISP is doing IPv6 and transforming for you, you will have to use their DNS, right?
Well, you have to use OpenDNS also provides IPv6. And you'd have to use that address, you know, 2620:0:CCC.
Yes, thank you, Miles.
--2, right? You know, it's something that doesn't quite roll off the tongue quite as well as 8.8.8.8.
Next time I forget that I'm calling you.
At 3 in the morning.
Miles.
Just look it up and, oh, your DNS is down.
Right.
So, Alex, you also have a story about helping the next administration deal with these issues?
Yeah, actually. Let me pull that up real quick. So, Schneier wrote an essay not too long ago, and he kind of summarized his view on what the major cybersecurity issues are for the next administration. He wrote this for Time.com. It was supposed to be, I think, published in Time in one of their – either Time Magazine or maybe it was in some other publication they put out, but he got bumped for Trump news or Trump information or Trump articles. So he's just put this out, and it's interesting. Kind of, he's very pro privacy. He's very anti surveillance. That's my general sum of a lot of his views there. Recently, I've been going through one of his more recent books, Data and Goliath, which I find interesting and really good to make a person paranoid, if you're not already. And even if you are, you're probably more paranoid. But he kind of covers a few key points, which I can easily summarize here. It's, you know, the first thing he lists off as one of the major cybersecurity issues is less surveillance. So he's, you know, essentially calling for less surveillance, pointing out how much the government, how much industry is been increasing their surveillance, as Miles mentioned earlier on an article. Another point is less censorship. There needs to be less censorship in general on the internet. He's pointing out there's a lot of censorships with other countries around the world, and these are sort of challenges to that an administration is going to have to recognize and deal with. His third point was less propaganda. Now, here he's kind of talking about free speech and how there's also an issue with that, and that there's a lot of erroneous speech, and it's starting to even be used as means of propaganda to influence political situations. You know, we have even currently with our own elections, we have China and Russia actively providing propaganda on social media networks with fake accounts and all sorts of things just to try and shift elections globally. Something that can be self-corrected, but it is an issue that needs to be recognized and dealt with. And his fourth point is less use of, or less, I'm not even sure what that means, less use control. So he's kind of saying governments need to ensure that our internet systems are open. So that we're not having totalitarian governments as much cutting off and controlling. Otherwise, we're losing a lot of what the internet is for and losing a lot of freedoms that are made available because of the internet.
Yeah. Well, I guess this, this article, this letter to the next administration is nice in the sense that there's at least some guidance of what to do in the, because right now it feels like kind of hopeless to my, you know, I feel in the space where, wow, this is bad and I don't see how it's really going to get better. So of course, assisting the administration makes sense. Miles, you have a story though about some people taking it upon their own skills to make things a little better. Yeah?
Yes, there was a case where someone hacked 10,000 home routers. This was a story from a little more than a year ago from Forbes, mm-hmm. where the thing is that this was illegal. You know, hacking into someone else's system is against the law. It's mm-hmm. a tort, just like if you were using the Mirai botnet right now, taking over everyone's cameras to be able to perform a distributed denial of service attack. But at the same time, I'm remembering we had these stories about how the home routers were, you know, had default passwords all the time. They just weren't secure. They had outdated firmware, things like that. And I think now with regard to Mirai, there's a different lens on it now to say, well, what if someone had released a bit of malware that went around and changed all the default passwords on all these cameras? You know, what if they went around and
most of the time the default password, when you reset it, when you do a hard reset, you get the default password back again. So if you were to go and just change all these devices so that they had a total random default password, the cameras would be non-log. You couldn't log into them anymore, and the people that own them would have to deal with it. And possibly that would actually assist, you know, help them figure out that they have to make their own password when they set them up. You're saying this Forbes article, though, is from a year ago, people modifying people's routers configuration, updating the BIOSes and affecting 10,000. Are you calling for people to do that again now?
That's a hard call. I mean, me saying that publicly, it would be inciting others to commit a crime.
That's
a bit of legal liability I don't want to get into. I do have to question whether or not it would make us worse off. Mm-hmm. It would be disruptive. A lot of people's cameras would stop working when they weren't expecting it, and there would be unintended consequences of that. Like something bad is going to happen. Someone's going to look and their camera wasn't running and, you know, they won't know what to do.
Alex, what do you think about this? Do you think it's justified? Do you think it's ethical?
I don't think it's a good practice overall I get the effect and the idea for it where, and it's not a new thought. I mean, this is something that was discussed even when we started having malware, almost 10 years ago. Becoming much more prevalent, people are saying, well, let's just write malware that goes on and turns on all the security controls and turns on your firewall and does all these other things, or clears out other malware. I don't know if that's a really good approach. It might kind of put a patch on the situation in terms of having a certain number of systems that are being remediated, but it's not fixing the problem. And if anything, I think it needs to be more pressure on the manufacturers for things that are being produced with insecurity. I think you got to keep a pressure on.
Right. But doesn't that put pressure on to say that the manufacturers that make these devices that are insecure by default keep failing?
Yeah.
because someone keeps turning them off remotely. That seems like, in my mind anyway, a lesser evil, especially when you're not actually invading that person's network, when you're not actually doing something malicious like doing identity theft or draining their bank account, that you're just performing a denial of service attack on bad practice.
You're performing a denial of service attack on consumers, though. And that's,
yes, you are.
That's,
but there's going to be a pattern to say, like, it's always going to be the same manufacturer that keeps having this problem.
Well, there's much more better ways I think you can approach it than actually attacking the consumer. I think
if that were true, wouldn't they have worked already?
No, because they haven't been tried. I think that the part of the problem is that you don't have enough support and backing on making sure that this is called out more publicly. That's actually what shifted when you look at the industry and when we had malware or flaws and vulnerabilities being found in Windows and all this other stuff. It wasn't attackers getting into the systems and causing things to crash that actually shifted the discussion and shifted the behavior of companies. It was that people started paying attention to the lists that were identifying vulnerabilities. People were making the news more often as these companies are not fixing things, and Microsoft started fixing their stuff. Other companies started fixing their stuff.
I get that, Alex, but I think that's a pretty slow path to success. Didi?
Well, I think it can be faster in some instances, like we saw recently with Samsung and their Galaxy Note 7. I mean,
when things start exploding in your pocket.
But that's just the point. Is that hype?
Like there are people out there. Like I met someone last night who is not wanting to get rid of their phone, even though they get a message every day saying they need to turn in their phone. But Samsung is doing everything it can because of all of the pressure it's getting from consumers and from news outlets and like just everybody from the FAA saying this needs to be taken care of.
I think one of the major problems with this IoT kind of botnet situation is that the consumer that bought that camera might not even be affected by it in almost any way. I mean, sure, the access to the camera and their privacy loss because of that, other people can access their data, that's problematic, but they might not be aware of that. But they're definitely not aware of the impact it has on the general population of the internet, which is actually the problem. I think it makes more sense for them, for the individual that owns a piece of equipment that is faulty, that is doing something harmful. They should have a negative effect of the equipment use, so they're aware of the problem. And it turning off to me seems like a pretty good solution. I think it's better than it bursting in, you know, on fire in your pants. But I get that it's a little bit strange that you're like, I bought a piece of equipment. It works perfectly in my function. It happens to also slightly degrade the user experience of the world, but, you know, only slightly.
Assuming they're aware of that. For the most part, people are just like, I bought a camera and I set it up and I can check out my kid from work, and that's great. And there's no feedback loop to actually make that change. There's no economic incentive for the company unless you bring in some type of major governmental regulation to say that all Internet of Thing devices must adhere to a certain level of security, in which case then you get into the enforcement issue, and then you get into what happens when the next stage in security vulnerabilities comes to play that we weren't aware of, because the law always follows where technology goes.
I don't think we've addressed really well why the botnet kind of problem with Internet of Things addresses is so difficult to fight, to combat. The real issue here is that it's massively distributed, and the requests that are being made are not detectable as faulty requests. They are just lots of requests. So
they look like normal users.
Yeah, they look like normal. So a local ISP, your company you pay money to give you internet access, they cannot see your traffic versus your bot's traffic being different. So they can't do anything about it. The individual user doesn't know what's going on in their network unless, of course, they've set up a good router like Alex has to see what all the traffic is on his network. And therefore, there's really no way from the request side, the bot side, to have anything done about it. And then the way the distributed network works in general, the receiver of it can just be like, yep, here's the 10,000 IP address that are hitting me right now. If they even know that, because of course the congestion can happen upstream of them. So that's why it seems so serious and seems like we need a slightly different tact to handle this.
Yeah, I think as far as the tact to take, though, it should not be one to basically disable the devices that consumers have purchased. I think that's a very – I also don't think that's going to be that effective, because you're largely talking about having to have as much hacking capability to be able to penetrate into the networks. I mean, you can get the low-hanging fruit, but you're still not addressing anywhere near the problem. 10,000 is nothing compared to the tens of hundreds of millions of devices out there that might have this problem. I really think it's got to be something that destroys the reputation of a company unless they take it seriously. I mean, even with Brian Krebs, he actually posted another article recently that when he listed all of the devices that were involved in the attack against him, he started getting some companies were actually saying they're doing recalls in the products, but he was also getting threats of legal action because of accusing companies of doing things badly or being part of an attack. When he was actually just calling out the product, the manufacturers and the products. But still, that at least got some attention, and it's getting a lot of those devices to fix their problems.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. If we had had ISPs set things up differently, if ISPs had owned the router that gave multiple IP addresses to the home, and that was configured by your ISP, so any device that wanted an IP address in your home was configured by your ISP, in some ways, that's a pretty valid way of the structure being set up in the first place. It wasn't, of course, because it started out that only people had one computer in their home, and so the ISP didn't have to do anything except for a modem. And then we actually bolted on the stuff necessary to make multiple devices connect. But if the ISP had done that, the ISP could be allocating IP addresses in the home network via MAC address only. This Internet of Things would have been, I guess, another level of complexity. Maybe it would never have launched. But you could see a configuration where there was a managed, controlled network at the opening of the internet that was doing exactly what you're doing, Alex, was, you know, making sure that the traffic was valid. In some ways, it seems like that we haven't made that an ISP role, I think, is democratic, but we definitely haven't empowered the individual user to be able to do anything like that because of the complexities involved in what I'm describing.
Yeah, well, a lot of that too. I mean, even if it was their responsibility, because of how TCP/IP is, we can easily just still have address information being netted. And that's ultimately what makes them blind to what's going on internally in the network or how many devices happen to be behind the router.
Yes, but the people that would be doing that, if the ISP was actually providing multiple IP addresses and controlling the DHCP in the local home and actually handling that another layer, the configuration, which is completely fictional that I'm describing, is that the most individuals don't do that. The individuals that do that would, of course, be able to do the NAT and manage their own network, and they'd be people like you and me that can actually handle the problem. But in any case, that's completely fictitious, and it's not that how the world works.
Yeah, I'd have all sorts of other problems with that, them being in my network like that.
Having not used this, this might be a naive question, but I'm wondering if things like what Apple is trying to do with HomeKit might help in the future if you had sort of a mediator, a middleman between your Internet of Things in the internet.
I think it's possible. I mean, a lot of what they're looking at is more about managing configuration, which to some extent could be good. But if you're dealing with a vulnerability that compromises it at the system level, I don't know how much that sort of environment would help. Because basically these are little computers. And while the software that runs on the computer that wants to integrate with, you know, with configuration information and control for the functional aspect of it, there's still that underlying operating system that has the ability to manage and control network access. So I don't know if that even would be at a level that could actually help with that in the long run.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not really sure about if you had something like HomeKit sort of monitoring traffic and alerting people in an Apple-ish friendly way, since they seem to be pretty good at that stuff.
It would be nice actually to see home routers start including more advanced features to help protect the internet from the bad stuff in the home. I would love to see that sort of thing, but you know, just in terms of monitoring the traffic within the device, not reporting it out, and to be able to identify, hey, that this is associated or known to be bad traffic, and you know, cut it off.
You know, something as easy as when you plug in your router and you have to first set it up, when you visit that web page, it says, hey, bookmark this page in your browser. You want to check this every once in a while. And then whenever you launch that bookmark, it shows you all the different, you know, clients that are connected, what the MAC address came from, what company made them effectively, and then how much bandwidth is being used by them. That level, I know it wouldn't help a lot of people, but it would help some.
I can think of a handful of people that would be of my friends that would be interested in that, and they are all geeks and capable of getting that information already. The general user is like, I want to get online and I want to see Netflix. And it's not so much that they don't care about those things. If you listed out those things and go like, oh, that'd be neat to have. But it's such a low priority in their life that it might as well not be there.
Yeah. They don't care. I'll say it. For a lot of that stuff, they just simply don't care.
I think that's a bit harsh, though. I think that there are a lot of people who would care. If you give them that list, it's like that'd be a really cool thing to have. But it's along the same lines as people talking about their 401k, and here's the day-to-day of what it's going to be doing, and here's the – and a lot of people were like, yeah, that's really cool. But a large majority of people, they put their money in their 401k, and they – set it up and they walk away and they do other things in their life.
This might just be setting up another vector for attack, but like if in the router setup it asked you to give a mobile number where you can get text messages for when weird things happen.
Yep.
Alex, you had another story about maybe the GOP is actually also getting affected as well. There's been a lot of stories, of course, about the Democratic National Convention committee being their emails and their systems being attacked by Russian government. But maybe they're not alone.
Right. So other reports came in out of the Netherlands that suggest that Russian hackers have been also attacking the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Largely, it looks like they've been hacking and trying to get to credit card process data. Basically, they're, if you buy yourself a pro-Trump or pro-GOP shirt or bumper sticker, flyers, whatever you use, it is that you can purchase there, they've basically been gathering and collecting a lot of information about the customers for that. So it's interesting that they've been siphoning it off. I think it's been reported that they're estimating about 6 months that this has been occurring for. So,
And these are Russian hackers?
Yep, that's what they believe. That's what the Netherlands have been suggesting. So, yeah. Russians are hacking everybody.
Miles, last week after we talked about all the software development stuff and looked at the old, and as we've been chatting this week about old shows we've done and shows that are actually kind of in archive form and aren't actually published very well, I was looking at some of the episodes that are up on our site, and I ran across an episode from 2003. 2003. We've been around here for a while. December 26th. Now, anytime you see a show of Geek Speak that's around the holidays like that, it means that I had to go down to the radio station by myself, or you had to go down to the radio station by yourself and do a show of some format, right? And there's not people are going to call in because it's like people are doing other things. So this show has had the title Child Development Technology. That's kind of interesting. And there was nothing else about it, just totally raw. Except for who was on it. It was you and me and John Tracy, who used to be on the show a lot. And
this was before I had kids. I think you had just had a child.
My son was born in 2001. So
So a two-year-old, and John had
probably
two
kids. Six-year-old. Yeah, two-year-olds, two kids by that time. So I started listening to the MP3 as I'm hacking away at other things, and it does some news in the beginning. It was actually a fun little news story talking about Russia and the U.S. to build a fast internet 2 is actually what we were talking about. The new processor with 90 nanometer paths, which is kind of funny.
What are we now down to?
40 or 36? I can't remember.
No, we're lower than that. Really? We're like 12 nanometer. That's now, awesome. Or something like that.
A federal district court had just ruled against photographers that they had gotten copyright. Given copyright to a magazine, sold copyright for the photographs to a magazine. The magazine had then published a CD version of that magazine. Mm-hmm. And you and I argued quite a bit about, is that a new form and therefore should be compensated? Or is it just another printing in a different form, like if you change the paper? And you and I argued about that. Very similar to how we argue now about things. It was really interesting. Anyway, so this little bit goes on.
In other words,
on.
We haven't grown as individuals. Great.
Some things just get more entrenched.
Exactly. Yeah.
Then the show jumps into a discussion about raising kids and using technology or not using technology with raising kids. Of course, this is years and years ago, and the kids that we're talking about are much older. So we may be doing a show soon to talk about this again and see what tactics on kid rearing was beneficial or not.
Right, but we were also talking about, at that time, it was 2003, so no tablets.
No.
No smartphones.
No Facebook, no Instagram.
It was – computer time was literally in front of a large, desktop or tower.
Or a laptop potentially. I think
we had laptops, but those were generally underpowered. We only gamed on the big stuff.
If you want to hear a little flash from the past, go ahead and watch that episode. But the reason I brought this up is that you've got a discussion about pediatricians thinking something different now about what they used to.
Right. The American Academy of Pediatrics has been revising their guidelines on tech and media. AAP has always been fairly conservative with regard to the technology use of young children. Mm-hmm. And I think rightly so. Like, we're not sure what the effect is going to be, so let's err on the precautionary principle.
Yeah.
They have, over time, kind of eased up on that, saying, you know what? It is okay. Infants that are from 0 to 18 months should be limited to video chat. Like, it's good to be able to have interaction with a distant grandparent or, distant cousins. And have that visual interaction, that talking interaction. So it's not games, it's not anything like that. It's just the conversation or the personal interaction. And as you get older than that, you start moving into the realm of it should still very much be limited. You shouldn't be having the kid watch TV all day. At the same time, they were saying that some of these skills, not the ones that have to do with spelling and letters per se at that early an age. This is, 2 years old, pre-2 years old.
Right.
Because young children don't see symbolic information the same way that adults do. Mm-hmm. It's just not helping them the same way to deal with the real world. They are, however, when they're older, it doesn't seem like it'd be a – they're saying that it's not a big deal for them to be watching high-quality content like a Sesame Workshop or PBS.
Okay.
And they do recommend that you stick with that high-quality content when, you know, they're 2 to 5 years old, that they do cut off all media when they have to, you know, do chores or eat dinner, you know, have that family time, that you limit it to only an hour or two per day.
Sure. All right, cool. So
I have to admit that I haven't been keeping my child to that limit.
Do you allow devices at the dinner table? Do you eat regularly at the dinner table? Or
we try to, yes. Mm-hmm. There are times we don't, that we sit in the living room and just relax. But there are a lot of times where we do come to the dinner table. And when we're at the dinner table, you know, there are no tablets at the dinner table. And I do get yelled at for bringing out my cell phone, and rightfully so.
I'm looking around my apartment now and going, what's a dinner table?
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know the Geek said hello. I want to thank our patrons very much. And also Chandler, who supports us, our intern, and Greg Merkley, who provides this week's working title, AI Strikes Over Internet of Things Accessibility. Nice. Thank you, Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, for providing our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 44 of our 16th season, or season 16. And Miles Elam, thanks for being here in the house with me.
Always a pleasure.
And Dee Dee and Alex, thank you so much for joining us remotely. I really appreciate your voices today and all the stuff you brought to it.
I'm glad to be able to join.
We come from space.
All right, yeah, Miles, go ahead and do that Apple story.
Yeah, there's.
Or I guess it's an Amazon story, huh?
Yeah, but Apple is suing MobileStar LLC for selling goods on Amazon that they're passing off as saying these are authentic Apple chargers, authentic Apple cables, and they're so not.
So you've bought one of these?
No. I personally haven't, but at the same time, I can see why Apple would be upset about this, especially when –
trademark infringement and all.
Well, especially because I think from Apple's point of view, they're upset about it because these chargers and cables tend to be faulty. The chargers tend to overheat and fail prematurely, and so it's just damaging their brand, yeah.
Yeah, I think
everything comes back to Samsung.
Yeah, I think Apple did an analysis on some of the fakes out there, and they were saying how they were missing – certain components that are meant for safety, and it was just bad.
Oh, I think – was that them or was that Google talking about the USB-C cables that were coming out that
No, it was about
missing resistors and stuff like that.
No, they were – it was about the little wall warts for hooking up USB charging. It was the – yeah, they weren't – the non-authentic Apple or non-Apple ones were
– You know, the one thing I'm very careful of, I buy stuff on crazy internet sites all the time for fun. I look at things and break things apart. I'll buy a cheap camera thing, rip it apart, and see if I can reuse the parts. You know, just I do that kind of stuff. But one of the things I'm always conscious of is where I bought the chargers, the USB chargers, and the battery chargers. And if I didn't buy that at a local store or, you know, a store I know I can sue for lots of money, I do not leave that plugged in without being around. So normally when I'm in the kitchen, you know, doing dishes and stuff, I'm charging like lithium ion batteries and stuff so that I can kind of be in the same room if they happen to explode, which they have in the past. Because if you plug one of those in and you leave the house for 4 hours and you have a problem, you have a serious problem.
Or they explode next to your head.
Yes, that happened to me too. Hey,
because he's all about safety.
So I've got a little story about a nightmare. I'm not going to write it up. I don't think I'll just talk about it. But it is a total first world problem. But Apple has Apple IDs. They also have iCloud. If you've had an Apple ID for a long time and you never did an iCloud account and then you upgrade your phone through AT&T, be extremely careful what occurs, because this is what happened to my relative. She goes and gets a new phone, and while the person at AT&T is helping, who is not capable and competent, a prompt came up that said, you know, you need an iCloud email address. And basically, even though you can use your own ID as your login authentication, and she was using her Gmail account, the iCloud username has to exist. So something at iCloud.com has to be connected to that account. So while they were typing this in, this kind gentleman employee decided to use her password that she had memorized for the Apple iCloud ID. This also set up her default email address. So 2 days later, as she started sending an email, not replying to an email, but sending an email from her her new iPhone, it was coming from the password she uses at iCloud.com. Sent that out to her friend. It, of course, comes back from her friend, and she sees it in the message. And it's her password in her email. And this doesn't make any sense. And so, of course, I get contacted, and a day later, I come to the house. And after explaining to her that she does now have to change her password because it's not going to fly to have this password. She liked this password. It was perfect. It had to change. I could not disassociate that email address, that iCloud email address, from her account. I could make an alias. We don't even need to use iCloud email at all. But I could not disassociate that. It's not used for anything because when you log into iCloud now, you actually log in with your Apple ID, which is her Gmail account. But I couldn't disassociate it. All I could do was destroy that account, create a new account, and then try to migrate her stuff and data over to the new account. But I wouldn't have been able to delete her old account, which had all her photo backup and her her iPhone backups on it.
Totally stuck. Not good.
So it was one of those situations that the only solution would be to contact Apple and get in a tech support call or go down to the Genius Bar. And I know that all that would be just more fodder for the end of this program. It wouldn't be useful in any way. So yeah. I had her change her passwords. I went and made sure she had, of course, that password being used multiple occasions with slight modifications to it, which in some sense, you know, I don't think I'm going to be able to get a password management solution to work for her. So that's the best offer I've got, you know. I basically said, don't use this password except for these three things, which are, you know, her important resources, if you will. And just accept the fact that that's the case. That's how it is.
Just gone in there and we'll sit there forever. Yeah. You know, it kind of reminds me of is that companies seem to have an issue with legacy account implementation. I think, Lyle, you had the same kind of problem with your Yahoo account. Yeah. I mean, not exactly, but, you know, you had an account that got tied to, like, your AT&T account or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, my Yahoo account, when I say go change passwords, I get put to an old, maybe obsolete AT&T account management page. I don't have an AT&T account. I try to move forward from there, and AT&T is going, what are you talking about? I go to Yahoo to try to change preferences. It bounces me back there.
Yep.
And luckily, the account doesn't matter to me, so I just, oh well.
I had the same problem. I have my account that it was tied to Pac Bell, and that got connected to Pac Bell. You know, which I don't even think Pac Bell exists as a name anymore.
But does the web page still serve Pac Bell logos?
I don't know what it was. I think it actually took me to AT&T, but it was tied to that old account that they connected back in the late 90s.
Yeah.
And so I could never – they started that enforcement where you couldn't actually log into it anymore. Well, Yahoo also used that same account for getting to your Flickr. And I had paid for my Flickr.
Oh.
And I could no longer get into Flickr. And I tried looking to find out how do you I sent emails to all sorts of contacts, never heard back. I eventually just wrote it all off. I'm like, I'm done with Yahoo altogether. And now with the recent news, I am so glad I'm done with Yahoo.
Yeah. I still have a Flickr account associated with that Yahoo account, and I can't change the password. It's so frustrating.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you know, there's nothing – I mean, my photos are there, and of course, the email that's there is a lot of email. I used that account as my base email for a long time, pulled all that out and, quote, you know, deleted it. But of course, it's not really deleted. That's really it's quite frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seriously annoying.
Yeah. Didi, any sort pain of, points this week?
Well, I just with what we were just talking about, it sort of reminds me of I forget, it was like maybe five years ago. A couple of big OpenID sites went down, or yep. They went out of business, and anybody who wasn't paying attention could have potentially gotten locked out of important resources for developers like Stack Overflow.
Yeah.
Oops.
That's a serious problem. So were you using one of these?
Yeah, I had my OpenID working as a delegate on my homepage, which come to think of it, you had me set up when we first started hanging out at UC Santa Cruz. You said everyone deserves their own little piece of the web.
Awesome. And now you have pain because of that. I'm sorry.
Oh, well, yeah, I was paying attention, so I was able to mitigate most of that before. But afterwards, there were a couple of points where I was like, am I going to be able to get back into this account or not? Sometimes I have to log in in just the right way to get it to work.
Yeah. It's interesting, of course, that at that time, that was before Facebook. So maybe you had like a MySpace page or something as an online of identity. And of course, the rationale I've always had is you should own the name of the thing that represents you online, right? So like I own my domain name so that I can do that. You own your domain name as well. And I'm sure, Miles, you have a domain name. Do you still have
I have one, but I mean.
The Iguana one or?
No, I don't have Iguana Charlie anymore. That was a while ago. Yeah, that was a blast from the past. I do have one, but I rarely ever use it.
Yeah, I mean, some recommendations that kind of came up to me for today is definitely don't. First off, don't have an email address associated with your ISP, because that will just never allow you to migrate. Right? Get if you have an SBC global email address, go get a different email address. Preferably by your own domain, all that, but don't worry about that if you don't want to. Just go get a Gmail account. I used to say, or a Yahoo account. Don't get a Yahoo account. And then migrate your data over, your information over, and slowly stop using that old email address. Because at some point, you're going to get a different ISP, you're going to move, and you're going to have to change, and it's going to be a pain. And the longer term you do it, the better it will be for keeping your records.